Welcome to Ars Politica, a podcast on political life, culture, and Christian political theory, with Stephen Wolfe and Thomas Acord. We seek to revitalize the Christian West and to restore the dignity, strength, and self-respect of Western civilization.
All right, welcome back to Ars Politica. This episode, we're going to do part two of our manliness series. Probably have numerous of these episodes. Last time we talked a little bit about Achilles, Aeneas, and some other aspects of manliness within the ancient world in Greece and in Rome. So we're going to continue that today. There's a lot to cover, but today we're going to focus on kind of estate management and also these two facets that I want to ask Thomas about, two facets of ancient manliness and its warrior and husbandman. And I'd like to ask him to kind of describe how those relate or just take it off and start talking about those two
things. Stephen said the last time we talked about this, in the ancient world, manliness, we talked about Achilles as sort of the prototypical man, but that's not the whole picture. There's more to it. You can take many classes on this. Books have been written about this. And I'll link some books below in the notes for you. Xenophon, a writer in ancient Greece, his name is Xenophon, he wrote a few books. One of them was on economics. And in that book, he talks about there's two main aspects of being a man in their world. One of them was being a warrior, and the other one was being what's called a husbandman. And husbandman, husband does not mean then what it means today. It doesn't mean the spouse of a wife, although it did include that. Husbandry today can also mean farmer, but that's not entirely what it meant then either. Husbandry during this time meant, as Stephen mentioned, managing an estate. I find this interesting just before we dig into the details. There are two main aspects of manhood in the ancient world. Both of them actually center around the home, the family, the property. One is being a husbandman, which is managing the estate, and the other is a warrior, which is protecting the estate, you know, your neighbor's estates. And so this is very interesting. And you can see both of these quintessentially in, again, Achilles as the warrior. And I mentioned in another podcast, Odysseus, he did not manage an estate in the Odyssey, but he was trying to get back to his estate. For me, when I think of paradigmatic ancient Greek men, what do I think of? I think Achilles as the warrior, Odysseus as the husbandman.
Yeah. And when we talk about the idea of a household today, we kind of think of a kind of a single family home, and where it's a place where you sleep and your family's there. And, but you leave it, you leave it every day and to go to work. Sometimes it's both parents or the man, husband and wife will leave the home. Kids will leave the home for education, and it'll be empty for many families throughout the day. But in ancient world, the idea of a household was very different. Thomas, you can go into a little bit how the idea of a household was there. I think it'd be important to kind of make a setting here. So when we start talking about household management or kind of the old concept of economics, what do we mean by household in the ancient world?
Today, we think of the household as this individual dwelling, single family home with the nuclear family. But household back in the ancient world was your extended family as well. Perhaps not to your cousins, but your parents, maybe even your grandparents, your children. This would have included servants, family members like your brother or sisters who attached themselves to you instead of going off on their own, which happened often. And different places in the world, people still live like this today. Some places where I saw, even in Europe, people still live several generations all in one house. Many Mexican people still live like this. We Americans tend to break apart and fragment pretty quickly. But the ancient world would have included all these family members. It would have also included something called an estate, which is anything that you own. So it could be land across town plus houses in a different area, anything over which you are you're watching, you're overseeing, you're managing. Business, your crops, servants, pieces of property, even animals could be part of your estate. And this is where the study of economics actually comes from. Economics comes from the Greek words oikonomos, economics, Oikos means home, nomos means law, so home law, home management. The beginning of the study of economics is actually the study of how to manage a household. And it's from the standpoint of a man, which is interesting because we think of women as, you know, these domestic creatures, not men. But there's actually a discussion in Xenophon about this, so we can get into it.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that the idea of economic production in the ancient world was not entirely, but it was often and typically centered around the household. And so there was, you could say it's like the house business, but the actual productive generation was not something done outside of households, but as part of households. And so again, the management, we'll talk about this, how there was a sense in which the wife was an integral part of the productive activity within the home. Of course, there are other responsibilities and duties as well. This kind of goes in part, I mean, I don't want to get into this too much, but there is kind of that critique of, well, the wife is just a housewife who dusts and cleans. Mm-hmm. You could say kind of a caricature, the stereotypical American housewife. In the ancient world, there was this, the household as its center of economic production was something where the entire family was part of it with the kind of headship of the husband. That's why, like today, equality might be plausible because if you're all working, if you're both working outside of the house, you both have an independent paycheck that goes into single or separate accounts, the idea of equality makes sense. In the ancient world, where you'd have to have a head or a leader of a household, it naturally went to the male, the husband of the kind of the patriarch, really the patriarch of the household. It was a matter of just. It would have seemed ridiculous, the notion of equality back then.
Yeah, the woman in the ancient world was part of this estate management. The people usually point to the Proverbs 31 woman, and you can see so many interpretations of this woman. She is a proto-feminist. No, she was part of the patriarchal oppression of women. There's different interpretations. I think the most accurate depiction is that, yes, she's buying and selling. Yes, she's managing. She's going to the store. She's going shopping. She's directing her servants and she's buying fields and things. But this is all part, the backdrop, the context to all this is estate management. There's some husbandman who is overseeing all of this, and she is working alongside him to manage things well underneath him. And I'm going to mention Xenophon a few times because he talks about this in a more detailed way. She is an integral part of the family. He doesn't call it a business, but that's what we would call it today. The nearest thing I could relate to people today is when COVID shut everything down and many people went home and worked from home. And there was lots of articles that came out from sort of these conservative websites saying, in some part, this is great. There's many bad effects because businesses closed up, but there were many good effects that we were able to stay home in the normal locus of man and woman. And so this Proverbs 31 woman is right in the middle of this ancient world, and she is a domestic creature, just like the husbandman would be. And so it's not abnormal. And I think one of the abnormalities is the modern world with all kinds of new inventions and appliances that a lot of our labor in the home unnecessary. There's a writer, I think it was some woman who wrote for Canon Press. I think it was called Eve in Exile. I forget the author. And she basically detailed how modern inventions sort of made the traditional role of women superfluous in the home. It used to take you all day to run the home. It would take you all day to clean clothes, all day. No, it just would take all day to clean clothes. It would take all day to make food. And so you would be constantly busy, constantly ordering servants around. But now you can push a button, you have 4 free hours. And it sounds nice. And that was like the 1950s poster housewife in high heels vacuuming. Women loved it for like a few years. And then they started to think, wait a second, I don't feel like I have purpose anymore. I feel like I have to go do something. And so I don't have many sympathies with feminism at all, but there is this sense in which the traditional role of the housewife managing an estate, and even the traditional role of a husbandman managing an estate, many of those roles are outsourced today. The modern world, like, why do we have all these books and conferences and themes and talks about manhood and womanhood? It's because the ancient way of doing it in many ways has kind of been outsourced through all kinds of other services. And
what we're dealing with today in terms of gender relations, and to do, there's the I guess there, you could say there's the woman question. There's a lot of fighting within the Christian world over what's kind of where do women belong? And it's like you said, it's because we've created these two functions of being this house management that also includes productive activity in some way is now split away from the house. And so men naturally then go out of the house to kind of be the breadwinner. That seems more natural, or at least kind of seems to naturally flow from the past. But now it's like, well, yeah, what do women do? I think that's part of what we're dealing with. And this is, and what we're talking about is not really new. It's, I mean, like Christopher Wiley talks about this in his books on household management. Really, in the ancient world, women were part of it. And men were at home. I think on this, I think that I'll praise maybe kind of traditional, but also millennials a little bit. It's fashionable now to beat up on boomers, which is an interesting change of thing. But millennial women, I think, not all, of course, but within the maybe the kind of conservative trad wing of it, are beginning to realize that if women can actually, they're not getting an income, they're not selling stuff when they stay home, but they are generating value in the home. They are the ones taking raw food, you know, the whole like kind of organic or unprocessed food, they're taking kind of raw food and making dinners and making food for the family. So that they're seeing how they're creating this nutritious meal by their own labor for the family. And there's these other ways that they can manage the household where it's not directly tied to some kind of public production of a product that goes into the market. Nevertheless, it still generates value beyond vacuuming or whatever. And so there is kind of this return to, again, praise millennials, to return to more natural stuff. And some of it's kind of been commodified and some of it's kind of silly and over the top. But I think at least the sentiment is right. So I kind of see that's kind of how my wife, in part, what she does for our home is that she doesn't like no processed food. She puts a lot of thought into kind of meal management, and then she homeschools the kids, and she brings the kids into, I mean, they're kind of young, but kind of into the managing of the house as well. I know Tom's, your wife, does all that as well. And so there is value being generated. It's just but it's adapting to kind of these conditions where productive activity has been split from house. But in the ancient world, all that stuff was kind of brought into one. And there's a lot of people talk about we need to return to productive households. And I mean, again, like you said, the ancient world just didn't have this issue. And we've just kind of, it's been raised because of certain material conditions.
So speaking of millennial girls, so getting back into the ancient world, one of the aspects of husbandry, so for the man, the ideal is to be a warrior and to be a husbandman. And we said that husbandry was managing an estate, which included managing a wife. And interestingly, Xenophon in his writings talks about some men are better at managing wives than others, just like some men are better at managing their servants. And they can start with a few crops and end up with many in life, or they can start with many and end up with few. The instruction of the husband, the oversight of the husband, all of these things comes under his purview, essentially. And we mentioned that the Proverbs 31 woman was an example of this very thing. And I'll make a special note here. People usually read the Bible, the Old Testament, sort of in isolation, but I would argue that Israel was a little sliver on the edge of the eastern edge of the Mediterranean in this larger culture that includes people from all regions of the Caspian Sea, all the way out to the Pillars of Hercules, North Africa, getting into the hinterlands of Europe. What you see applicable in one area might transfer over to another. And I think this Proverbs 31 woman definitely does. But the another aspect of being a husbandman was that, you know, some people said that this wasn't you would rather be a warrior. It's better to be a warrior. And often you think of a king or think of some manly man defined in isolation to women or children. But this wasn't the case. The kings of Persia, for instance, prided themselves on being husbandmen. And I don't mean husbands like today, but for instance, Cyrus, one of the great princes, not the king Cyrus, but one of the princes. He was such a good manager of estates that one time a visitor showed up and said, you know, Cyrus showed him some parks that he had, that they were built for him. And the guy said, wow, the alignment of the trees is so perfect and neat. And I can't believe who of your servants did this. And Cyrus said, I did it with my own hands. I did it. This, you know, this guy was amazed. And he said, what do you mean you did it? And he said, well, I think it's part of being a man, said Cyrus. You don't spend one day without some physical exertion with your hands. You dig in a garden a little bit. You plant some flowers, you plant a tree, you go look at your horses in the stalls. You do something physically to manage your estate. You personally do it. And this was seen as being a man. And this is where you get sort of the warrior who goes back home and gardens. And you can kind of see this trope throughout history. Even in movies, one of my favorites is The Last Samurai. And Tom Cruise is this Western white dude who gets captured in war with some samurai. And he goes prisoner of war and he goes and lives with them. And he finds out these people, these warriors, live peaceful, quiet lives. And that's all that they really want. They're warriors when they have to be. And they practice it and they're very deadly. But they do that so that they can go back to their small garden and their quiet home. And I think that's the perfect picture that we're describing here. You can look at this with David, King David. He was a warrior. But once the wars were over, he wanted to build God a house, a temple. God told him, no, you can't, because you've been such a warrior. You've overdone it. There's blood on your hands. My house won't be built. It'll be built by your son. And so his son was sort of the husbandman. You got David, just like, this is what's beautiful about the Bible and the classics. Why? You should read the classics. If you're a Christian, you should read the classics. Why? Okay, you have Achilles, who's the warrior, and Odysseus, who's the husbandman. Well, in the Bible, you have David, who's the warrior, and Solomon, who's the husbandman. The parallels break down at some point, but you get what I'm saying. He builds the temple. He oversees the maintenance of Israel and the flow of government. And he's an exemplar, right? Par excellence. He does a great job at being the husbandman. He ends up being a husbandman to 700 women or something, which is not reputable. He shows how someone leads, someone earns, produces, commands, oversees. He does it in a way that prospers Israel like it's never known before or after.
When you think of those two facets, to be a warrior and husbandman, it's easy. I think in our circles, maybe not so much in kind of liberal and left wing, but in the right wing circles, you think of one as being the warrior is you in this posture of trying to kind of dominate your enemy. So there's like this idea of dominion, of defeating your enemy, of kind of taking over that kind of taking dominion, let's put it that way. And then you get back home and it's, well, now it's peace and you get soft and fat or something like that. And you're all domesticated and you're, you know, your wife controls you or something like that. And so that's what you think. Oh, now you're a husband. And actually the modern concept of that husband means nothing, but you have some relation to another woman, you know, like you have a wife, actually shows what I'm getting at, which is in the end, to be a husband is to be nothing but a man who's attached legally or whatever to a wife, so, or to a woman. Whereas back then it meant there was less of this division. I guess at least in principle, I'm sure there are examples of the contrary, but that you come back to an estate and you exercise dominion over that estate. Now I know that dominion's kind of this scary word that you say nowadays, everyone on Twitter gets crazy. And also in books and John Wayne and that sort of, you'll hear about that later. But nevertheless, there was, it's a different, I guess you could say, species of dominion, or exercising dominion. Nevertheless, there was a dominion over that space. And that doesn't mean kind of this, like your wife and kids are slaves to you. It just means that you exercise this general, you have a household with a land, with capital, with people who are a part of it, and you have a certain status of command in relation to not only people, but also animals And so there's no kind of division between that divinity. But nowadays, and I keep jumping the modern thing and we'll jump back to ancient, but there is that sense of, well, you go back to your house and this is a feminine space. And that's not your wife's fault. It's just, that's how things are arranged nowadays because of all sorts of reasons. But I think within the far right world, I think of someone like Bronze Age Pervert in his book, Bronze Age Mindset. He has this, in some ways, it's a very interesting book, but he has this sense of the man is like this warrior who's like a pirate, you know, who goes around and he fights and dominates. And there's something to that. And I think that's why it appeals to a lot of kind of young men. At the same time, he has no sense of like family. He has no sense of being married, having kids. He has no sense in that of having like a continuity of like we talked about the Burkean concept of dead, living, and unborn. Everything is like this fleeting, not necessarily fleeting, but it's this drive to kind of have this domination. It's very kind of like almost that your name in the world is nothing but your great accomplishments that live on, that people talk about. And we talked about this before, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it's incomplete because like you said, part of being a man is having this household where you have a certain, you have headship and exercise a certain degree of a certain type of dominion. So I think that's a corrective, I think, to the far right, that yes, we should talk about this warrior aspect, but we need to start thinking, I think, more creatively about that other aspect of manliness that was in the ancient world that hopefully going to bring back.
I would call what Bronze Age Pervert is writing about. He takes selections, these young, vibrant men sailing around together, sort of like Jason and the Argonauts, the 50 hottest, baddest dudes in the ancient world. And they go sailing on a quest and they land on like Maiden Island with all these girls who just lost all their husbands. And it's just like this wild riot wherever they go. There's also the end of the tale where Jason goes back to, I think it was Colchis or wherever he was from, and establishes his kingdom. So it's like Jasonic or manhood or in the ancient world or something. There is this reality that a great ideal, I mean, Odysseus is a big critique to all of this. His whole goal was to get back home and to be loved by his kin, by his neighbors, to be respected by those around him, to have the suitors seeking after his wife flee and disperse, to have the respect of his offspring and to grow old with those around him. That was something that was seen as one of the highest ideals of to which he would even give up being with divine beauty incarnate in some grotto for life or whatever. He gave it up. He gave up all kinds of things for this. This is a big theme in the ancient world. Another one dealing with husbandry and managing an estate. We mentioned that the woman would be something to be managed as well. Feminists may not like this, but the woman is usually married young, 14 years old or so. And therefore, she's not very experienced in managing a household. So she would need instruction. And it was always seen as the man's role to instruct the wife. So you manage, she's like an under manager or something, but he manages her and teaches her. So if a wife ruins the house, the estate, the marriage, it's the man's fault. And the Bible kind of talks about this when it says the woman is the glory of man. Your role, and even Paul says this, you can't manage a church if you can't manage your house. You're supposed to be managing your house. You're supposed to be overseeing it. And there are many documents that show men giving advice to their wives, continual advice, like not just, oh, by the way, but I mean like a tutelary instruction in household management. And you see this all the way in, even into the 1800s. For instance, when many Civil War soldiers went off to their units to fight in battles, North and South, they would, a lot of the letters to the soldiers wrote to their wives. You can look this up. Forget the author's name. It's called For Cause and Comrade, though. The book is called For Cause and For Comrade. Their letters back home to their wives are instructing them in how to take care of the house while they're gone. It's not because the women were dumb and they just didn't do anything. It's because the man was the main overseer and she followed his instructions and held to it. You can see this in the Middle Ages. There's a book called The Goodman of Paris, or the Parisian Household Book. It's basically a Frenchman wrote a book in the 1300s to his wife. Letters were compiled into a book. basically on how to manage and run a household. And it includes everything like recipes, how to launder the clothes, how to deal with the servants who might try to steal from you, how to hold yourself in society. Well, there's also this in the ancient world as well. Men writing instructions, giving instruction to their wives in household management. Even this is something you would pass down to your children also. So for instance, the Proverbs 31, which we mentioned, was not this nice bit of poetry about a woman. It was actually in the instruction of a parent to the child, the male child, for what to look for in a wife and how to actually go about cultivating your wife in this direction. And some men did it well, some men didn't do it well. But the goal or the context was there's a household and an estate to manage, and we're a team together doing this, but there is a structured order. And I think what Stephen has mentioned a few times, sort of the problem in today's world is that we don't see the household as this thing to manage. Women see it, or they're taught to see it, as this thing which, from which you flee. We go back there and park our cars and go to sleep, and you sort of feel listless. You're the center of your life is not there. And so there's no real leadership for the man. Like, what leadership do you actually exercise over your wife, over your family, if you don't have any joint partnership together, any joint venture together? If your household is just a place where you park your car at night. And so this is a real problem. And I think Stephen's right. Many millennials are see it, and we're actually trying to do something about it. Good on you if that's what you're doing. And it's a worthy venture, and it's not something new. We're doing something actually very ancient.
There's all these forces trying to tell women to kind of lean in and to kind of join the commute traffic with the rest of us, you know? So it's, I think it's just really important to kind of point out just the value generated, and also just, there's something about this idea of household management that seems very unnatural to just drive, be away and come back, and I think it creates a lot of bad dynamics. But if you know, something I thought about, I think you just read this book. Anna Karenina, I think.
Yeah.
I'm
I was thinking of that too.
So it's probably one of my, it's like in the top five of my favorite novels. I'm in the middle of reading it now. I think I have about a couple hundred pages left, reading it again. And I think of, Levin. So not Anna, but Levin, I just love that character. He is a guy who's just kind of consumed with his yeah. own estate management and how mm-hmm. and more than that, how do you manage the peasants and how do you treat them as he really treats them as like realistically who they are. He doesn't have these ideals right. or ideology. They're just they are who they are, and you have to work with them as you work with them. Right. And it's kind of refreshing to hear him just like these fresh takes on peasants. but yeah, it's just a great picture. And then he marries Kitty, and she, somewhat they have like a Rousseauian marriage. I mean, this isn't a podcast. Anyway. So people are wondering, I'm not going to read a 800 page book, so stop talking about it. But anyway, it's just a great, great picture of kind of this idea of loving the land and place and bringing your wife into that and having this relationship working things out.
I would sorry to cut in here, but I just want to emphasize what you said, that Anna Karenina is a great book. I was actually thinking about it, forgot to mention it, but there's examples in that book about the failure of that relationship where a Karenin, the man who is married to Anna Karenina, I think this is my personal interpretation, but I think he did a terrible job of leading his wife. And even during the whole time where, spoiler alerts here, if you don't know this, if you're going to read it, but the whole time she is, you know, disloyal to him, which is basically the entire book. Yeah. He just kind of lets it go, and he lets his estate go, and he just lets everything go, and everybody despises him for it. He just lets himself, his estate fall apart. But Lievin, I've heard it said Lievin, but Levin or Lievin, he is like very intent on managing his estate. And that turns into a healthy relationship with his wife. The contrast is so clear in the book. A man who manages his estate is careful to also manage, okay, or oversee his wife. And this is a loving, beautiful relationship that flourishes between the two. Whereas the other one, contrasted in the book, totally flops and falls apart.
Yeah, and it's so true. I mean, the idea that that Kitty breastfed her children. That's kind of a minor thing. I think it's a minor thing in the book.
Yeah.
But that was not a bit, that was weird in Russian aristocratic circles, where there was this sense. And again, it's like, I think Tolstoy was influenced by Rousseau, but it was all for breastfeeding, mother breastfeeding. Anyway, you definitely have this, like, she bringing her into this life and of the estate. And the contrast between kind of the Karenin and Levin is that Karenin, like you said, he was also obsessed with kind of like decorum, and also his role outside of the house as kind of a public leader, whereas Levin didn't really understand that public stuff and thought it was all kind of fake. And he was very insular in the family home. So there's a contrast between that, which kind of segues into what I wanted to kind of move into for a moment. We've talked a lot about how kind of looking inward into the home, kind of almost since you think of it as a sphere, and you're oriented toward the household. There is a sense, and I think that this is where people like Alistair Roberts and some other guys who are talking about kind of masculinity will say, and some other kind of quasi feminists have said this, they wouldn't like the label, but that there's an outward facing, that men also have this, not just an inward focus of, you know, let's make sure everything's in order inside, but also a headship that faces outward. In a sense, the man, I think in the ancient world, people think, oh, is like these commentaries say, everyone, you know, like everyone in democratic Athens could vote, but, you know, actually only men. Oh, and had to be wealthy, but, or whatever, I forget the exact conditions were, but they had to be men. Right. And the reason for that wasn't simply just, you know, a misogyny. It was that the man of the household was kind of the household rep, or the head of that household. And so was a public person in the sense of being a member of a representative of that household in relation to other households, other kind of civic institutions, and ultimately the state. Okay, so that there's this facing outwardness and not just this inwardness, and this is why I think like Aristotle and others will say, well, really what composes a civil community is a collection of not individuals, but a collection of households. And so if you have a collection of households, well, who has the vote or the franchise? Well, it's the men. So this is one reason why, like 100 years ago, when they were against women's suffrage, it wasn't because women couldn't vote, or they thought it was ridiculous. They're all they're unintelligent. It's that it undermines that relationship between the family and the state, or the family and kind of the civil community. And so I think that outward focus aspect is I think it's very important. And I think that jump into the modern world again, When we talk about equality and just material conditions, the economy, how the labor market works, it kind of it individualizes everyone, so that no longer is our community a collection of households, or kind of is, but it also isn't. Now it's, well, husband and wife can vote differently. They don't often do that, but they vote differently, or one is a vote. And so they're both public people. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, the household itself just becomes a place of, I guess refreshment and sleeping, and it's really not, it's not even, you know, you can, or some basis to reduce your taxes. But it's not like this, it's not a one part of the whole of a civil community. And again, like you can say it's misogyny, but it makes sense why men would be in that ancient world would be kind of the public figures, given their status in the household and the household status in relation to the civil community.
So it was a good point about the modern world breaks up the household, and through voting, this is not about keeping women enslaved, or early feminists might've said, they called marriage slavery too. I mean, everything's slavery. Voting breaks up the household politically. You divide yourself fairly on the foundations of society, and the household's divided, or you just merely multiply the vote. But it used to be that households vote. Not even all men could vote forever. Every democracy in the history of mankind never allowed just everybody to vote, or even all men. It was only it was people who owned estates, essentially. And the reason wasn't to favor the rich over the poor. It was We need people. The same, I would argue, I think I have a basis for it, for the same reason Paul said you have to manage a household well to be an elder in the church. We're not just going to allow anybody. You need to be able to manage people, manage things, manage stuff, land, buildings, money. You need to be able to manage people dynamics, personalities, young, old, rich, poor. And if you can't do that, then you're not fit to manage this other estate called the church. You're not fit to manage this other estate called the state or the polis. And this is one thing that anybody who hires people knows what I'm talking about. If you own a business or you run a business and you get a brand new college grad who's never done anything other than study books, that person may be really, really wonderful, but they've never wielded authority before. They've never had to really submit to authority, like real show up on time, paycheck authority. You know, you have some training to do for that person, and you have to watch out. You're not going to give that person a lot of authority. That's the same way people used to look at politics. You're not going to give the control to people who have never controlled things before. And to do so is actually to harm them. This is one of all the theories of people moving into a state of freedom from oppression or from rational self-government, from ignorance. Anyway, so the idea of keeping the household a unit was very central. And I think if you look at almost all political philosophers, it's almost like this obvious statement of fact that you could just assume that the family is the basis and the household is the basis. It's like the first society, the first little society that you're born into. And sort of the modern theory is that you're born a blank slate, you're born without any prior social commitments, was sort of a new thing on the stage of history.
We can move to probably the most dangerous portion of the podcast. We keep it to the end where most people have dropped off and said it would have been better at 25 to 30 minutes, but you kept going. So there has in the Protestant world, I don't follow the Catholic world, sorry Catholics, but in the Protestant world in the world, there's been a lot of conflict over the place of women in the church, but that relates to households. And there's been a series of books have come out, a lot of kind of drama, controversy and drama that has led to ecclesiastical discipline against pastors. Or at least attempts to do that. A lot of drama. So I'm going to let Thomas get in trouble here, and I'll let him talk about it, and then maybe I'll sign off and get some coffee.
Get myself in trouble. Thanks. All the controversy will come my way. Thanks a lot. But I saw a book 2 years ago now. Yeah, 2 years ago it came out, and the author of the book, it's called Beyond Authority and Submission. And I don't want to pick on this particular author. I don't know her, but the argument. The historical data in the book was so inaccurate that I could not sit by and think. And it ran in my mind, like, how does this even get published? Surely the editors, someone must know, have special knowledge about. And the argument in this book was essentially that Christians today have wrong views of the roles of men and women. And we got them from this Victorian era, the 1800s in England. And England in the 1800s was just copying these gender roles from the ancient world, just verbatim copying these roles. And these roles are unbiblical. And all we did apparently was we took them and Christianized them. And then that's what England did. And then the Americans took them and we baptized them in American evangelicalism. And so I'm not going to critique the whole book here. What I'd like to say is when you encounter general feminist historical revisionism, and this woman might not consider herself a feminist, I don't know, but her historical revisionist history is a feminist one. I would encourage you to spend some time in the primary text yourself. The ancient world was very complex. And when anyone tries to use it to paint some sort of new agenda or accuse people today of things in a very simple manner, simplistic manner, it's usually they're using history as a tool to serve some kind of vision that they have. The ancient world, was it this purely patriarchal world? Well, for the most part, men did rule and they did govern. They did manage their estates and they did write laws and they were kings. But the women, as we mentioned, also had a lot to do. And it wasn't just this one-for-one copy-paste into the modern world. And nobody has ever done that. In fact, this is an odd argument to make, especially in Victorian England, because Friedrich Nietzsche actually critiqued the 1800s Christian world for being nothing at all like the Greeks. And he said, we actually need to go back to the Greeks and be like them in order to will to power and triumph over them. He has a completely different thesis. It's not even near what this woman says. So the idea in this book is the ancient world was one of just men rule, women submit. That's not the same, the view of the ancient world that you get when you read these books. For instance, feminine characters, female characters, play prominent roles at all levels of society. There's feminine gods, there's female gods, and they're powerful. And I mean, Hera and Alecto and Athena and so on and so forth. There's some Aphrodite. They throw battles. They kill men. They change the course of history, these female characters. And you might be thinking, oh, yeah, it's the gods. Well, the gods were important to these people. Okay, I know we think that they're all fake, but they didn't. They thought this stuff was real. And you have other feminine characters. I can go on and on and on. You know, some of the famous ones you might know are people like Cleopatra. But you even have the emperors of Rome. Their mothers got involved in politics pretty powerfully. And there were queens. There were a whole tribe of warrior women called the Amazons. And they weren't, you know, some inconsequential group of warriors. There's women who lead men like Medea basically saves Jason time and again and gets him out of trouble. And I could just quote on and on and on. The women changed the course of history. It's not a clear cut way of just, you know, which part of all of this did Christians borrow? It's not clear. Now I'm kind of muddying the waters right now with gender roles and saying it was all over the place. And the big picture here that I'm trying to pitch is that when people use ancient Greek and Roman history and they simplify it to these stereotypes, that's actually, it's usually not accurate and it's not helpful, especially when you're going to critique, you're going to claim that people are borrowing them today and copying them one for one. However, I would say that on the common level, for the common man and woman whom we have only, you know, narratival history, the roles that we see were ideal man was the warrior and the husbandman. And you see these prominently in King David and Solomon, in Achilles and Odysseus. You can see them also in some of the kings of Persia that I mentioned. You can see this done badly, but you can see it, the same trope throughout all history. I think that resonates with people today. The most recent thing that happened was the lockdown and people went home. And we all started to consider what life was like at home and working from the home, and how natural that is and how healthy it might be. And millennials, particularly different from maybe the late boomers or the Gen Xers. And who knows what the Zoomers are doing right now. We sense this and we think there's got to be some center hub for us to do life from and to manage things together well. And again, that's a natural, a normal, a very old way of relating as male and female. And you can find ample evidence of this, beautiful examples of this in the ancient world.
I also think that critique that, well, you borrowed all these concepts from either they're like Victorian and or they're ancient Greek ideas. Part of me just wants to say, I haven't read the books, but part of me wants to say just, well, you know, so what, you know, I think we've already kind of critiqued gender relations in the modern world now. So, I mean, I guess in some sense we get that there could be a critique, but that the idea that there are these kind of structures of authority that we're trying to apply given our circumstances, and that they might resemble in some sense how best, I guess, of the pagan world also assemble each other. Well, that's just, again, so what? And this goes back to, we don't have to go through two kingdom theology again, but it's the idea that, look, I mean, there was a sense in which that we're all humans, and that and the fall didn't entirely wreck us in terms of figuring out, well, how are we supposed to relate to one another as man and wife? There's all sorts of problems and sin, but at the same time, the principles weren't extinguished. And so if people arrange themselves in this way and Christians look back and said, well, that was suitable and fitting given our nature and our understanding, and then so be it. It just seems to me that the critique itself is itself just, it fails just prima facie to say, well, it's false simply because you looked at the Greeks. I mean, if that were the case, then practically all the politics of the early modern period, I mean, the late medieval period, is completely gone, right, because right. they appealed to, I mean, I was reading the, I mean, just take like Bartholomew Kekerman, which no one's heard of, but his whole entire political treatise in 1610 or whatever it was Plato said this, Cicero said this, Aristotle said this. And so the whole thing was, hey, civil government's a human institution. Civil society is a human kind of society institution. And Aristotle and Plato and Cicero were right. So to say that, well, these guys talking, this sense of masculinity, manliness in the Asian world is false, is just on its face.
Right.
That form of critique literally destroys the entire Christian political tradition. You know, so what, why, if not that, then why same thing with household management or relations of genders. So,
it would be naive if it weren't arrogant. I mean, I would like to call it naive, but it seems also arrogant, because what you're saying is everyone before me has gotten this wrong. Absolutely everyone. The Christians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, the Jews, the Persians, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Germanic tribes, the Moors, the Turks, the Ottomans. I mean, like you just keep going on and on. But finally, I have arrived with this solution, which happens to fit precisely with the predominant political ideology of the age, and, you know, gets me accolades and things.
It's pretty hilarious that somehow these, like, the obvious Christian egalitarian notion of gender roles is somehow fits perfectly with our modern conditions. You know, it's just one of those, in some ways, it's just kind of laughable. That's not to say that they are false because of that, but it's just too convenient when somehow the Christianity inaugurated social relations and gender relations that just happen to fit perfectly within, you know, 2020s, 2021s, notion it's just kind of silly.
So to summarize everything we've said, you know, what's the sum of this? Why are we even talking about this? One of the big reasons is we wanted to follow up last time and give a more holistic picture of manhood in the ancient world, both warrior like Achilles, husbandman like Odysseus, and to say to any of you who are trying to navigate the new cultural climate that we find ourselves in, you know, post-industrial or whatever, post-liberal, if you're trying to live in a way that is more home-centered, if you're trying to be a husbandman, young men, or in this way that we're talking about, and you're trying to lead your wife in this, it's a worthwhile effort. And there are many of us who are doing the same thing. And we have a long pedigree of people in the past doing this from the ancient period all the way up into, we mentioned some of the examples of the 1800s. And so good on you. Go for it. We're part of the same effort.
What I wanted to mention before we go is that we're going to start, we've started a Patreon account. And I just wanted to bring that up. Neither of us are in this to make money, nor do we expect to make money doing this. But there have been a few people who've said, hey, how can we support you? And believe it or not, there are costs to doing this, even though everyone's doing a podcast nowadays. But there are some costs associated with this. And if you want to kind of support us in that, you should be able to find our Patreon on our page. And again, it's not for money. We're not trying to be grifters. If we were grifters, this show would be different. But anyway, if you feel like, hey, you could support us, we definitely appreciate that. So, all right, we'll be back hopefully next week. So, see you later.
Thanks for listening to our discussion on manhood and womanhood in the ancient world. If you like us, you can check us out on Patreon. You can reach us at arspoliticapodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and just Gab as well.
3 dead in a crash on a number 4. 2 witnesses blown up high. Not sure whose will be done. You can call me a sinner for wondering why. Hey, darling, sleeping on the blacktop. Hey, darling, running through the trees, honey. Hey, darling, leaving for the next time. Lesson my set sketches up with me.